Okay, I started the tape, so I guess we're officially starting. Oh, she pushed the button. We're going. Okay, good. All right. So where were we? Now, like I said, that first class that I did is definitely my least favorite class in the whole series. It's like, it's a little bit depressing to think about what happened, especially in the church in the West, and the things that were brought on because of that. But the nice thing is, now we get to switch over to talking about stuff that I definitely like talking about. But let's summarize very, very briefly what the religious scene was in Western Europe as we're leaving the 15th century and entering the 16th century. So, understand that Western Christianity, as Brian Craig pointed out, was dominated by this one overriding doctrine, which is the doctrine of purgatory. And so Christian lives were centered around being ransomed from the situation of being in purgatory. Your salvation depended on these acts, some of them sacramental acts, others of them indulgences and pilgrimages. So the idea of penance, the idea that that you had to do a certain number of Hail Marys and Our Fathers and these kinds of things, somehow that would undo the sins you'd committed. That, of course, in 1 John 1, we know that his blood cleanses us from all sin, correct? We had masses, and the number of masses that were done, meaningless ones. In fact, Brian mentioned that Martin Luther would observe these things, and of course he was horrified by this. Confession, pilgrimages, crusades, indulgences, building of chapels, cathedrals, the cult of Mary. Another thing was this cult of penitentes, where people would go down the streets and whipping themselves and wear clothes with thorns in them and crazy stuff. All right, but then we had our reformers, and the first strong winds of reform came from England and from Bohemia. John Wycliffe, the first great reformer, he was English, he was a don at Oxford. He was principally an educator, he was an unwilling reformer. Basically, he was just a professor, a little bit like Martin Luther. But he got caught up in the events. His conversion event was political rather than religious. What happened was Pope Urban V in 1365. No, I will not test you on the year 1365, by the way. And you don't even need to know about Pope Urban, right? Got it? But he demanded tribute from King Edward III of England. And basically, What the Church of England did, they did a little assessment. They found out that something like 60% of all the land in England was owned by the church. And most of these church people weren't even English. So it's kind of like a taxation without representation thing. So here we go. Already, well over a third of England is in the hands of the Pope. There cannot be two temporal sovereigns in one country. So basically, King Edward said, good job, John Wycliffe, for defending our autonomy from these, you know, overlords who were stealing all our money. So, again, like what happened with Luther almost 200 years later, the state began to support this reformer for political reasons, not necessarily for religious reasons. But then, very soon, his convictions about about the Bible and about Christianity stepped in, and he became the great reformer that John Wycliffe was. In 1378, he published On the Truth of the Holy Scripture, in which he argued that the Bible is the only rule of faith. Remember, one of those pillars of authority was the Catholic rule of faith. And he demanded, as Luther did, about 150 years later, that the Bible should be translated into the vernacular because almost nobody had any access to the scriptures at all. Now, of course, in 1979, when he published his English Bible, probably only, 3 or 4% could actually read. But anyway, to the landed, educated aristocracy, they now had access to the Bible. In 1379, again, you don't need to know the years, he published The Power of the Papacy, in which he called the Pope the Antichrist. That was not likely to win a whole lot of friends in Rome, you can imagine. And he said, Jesus is the head of the church, not the Pope. Thank you very much for noticing that. And he said, the Lord's Supper is only a reminder. Now, that whole thing about the Lord's Supper and Luther stand on that, and then Zwingli stand on that, that's going to be a big issue. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And basically, to Wycliffe, the greatest enemies of Christianity were the Dominicans and the Franciscans. But that's that stuff that I skipped. Those slides that I went zip, because we don't have time. So basically, he wrote against all these friars and monks and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, oversaw a translation of the Bible. Now, Wycliffe's translation was into what we'd called Old English. So impossible for you and I to read it. And besides, he didn't translate from the Greek. He translated it from the Vulgate. So this was the first English Bible ever. Not a great translation, not useful to us, but nevertheless, it was made available. And then, as had Waldo, Peter Waldo, he suggested that lay preachers should be allowed, not just ordained priests. So he was called before the bishops to renounce his refusal of transubstantiation. And he said, the truth shall prevail. Very similar to the scene of Luther 150 years later at the Diet of Worms. You know what's amazing? They didn't kill this guy. It's incredible that he was not killed. But he wasn't. Especially when he opposed idols, indulgences, purgatory, the priesthood in general, and when he called the Pope the Antichrist. Wow. Right? Yes. The Archbishop of Canterbury, who was the head of the English church there, said, if we permit this heretic to appeal continually to the passions of the people, our destruction is inevitable. We must silence these Lollards. I don't know why they call them Lollards. They should have called them Wycliffeites, I guess, but for some reason they were known as Lollards. And the amazing thing is he died peacefully in 1384. It's just the church had not gotten around to getting him executed. But in 1401, his movement was denounced as heretics. And in 1415, at the same assembly of the church that burned John Huss at the stake, they pronounced him a heretic. He'd been dead for 31 years, but, better than nothing. And so what they did was they dug up his bones, they burned them, and they threw him into the river. So I guess he got the last laugh. Now, Wycliffe's movement never died. There were still people who were committed to the idea of Reformation. But his Reformation was not successful in that it was not supported by the leader of the country, so it could not have a general effect in England. Okay, more permanent was the Reformation of John Huss. Wycliffe and Huss are amazing heroes of the faith. The courage, the physical courage they had to risk their lives. John Huss from Bohemia. Now you ask, where's Bohemia? Well, it doesn't exist anymore because the Inquisition basically destroyed the entire nationality of Bohemianism. Now, we think of Bohemian, the Bohemian people, they wear messy clothes and they're into arts and all that kind of stuff. So the word Bohemia exists. So he was Bohemian, and the capital of Bohemia was Prague. So this would be where the Czech Republic is. And like Wycliffe, he was a brilliant scholar. He became the dean of philosophy at the University of Prague. At a very young age. And in the year 1402, a momentous point in the Reformation, he was given the pulpit in the chapel of Bethlehem there in Prague. So basically, he became the principal preacher in the city of Prague, the fact that he was given the pulpit there, and he began to preach in Bohemian. In other words, he wasn't preaching in Latin, so people could actually understand what he was saying. He wasn't quite as radical as Wycliffe. He was a little bit more careful. He didn't necessarily throw out all of Catholic teachings. I believe he held on to transubstantiation, for example. But in Prague, he restored the cup of the Lord's Supper in both kinds. You're saying, what are you talking about? For centuries and centuries in the Catholic Church, they only got the bread. The wine was too holy. So they, you know, only the priests would ever even have the wine. They only had the, yes, that's right. So he said, you know what? Maybe we should have both the bread and the wine. So they began to do that there in Prague. That alone would get you executed, I'm telling you. And he preached in the Bohemian language. And have you ever heard of Good King Wenceslas? Yeah, he was the king of Prussia. And he's good partly because he was friends with John Huss. Question. All right, have there been more martyrs of Christians from other Christians than from Muslims? I don't have statistics, but I'm sure by far, I'm sure it's not even close. It's not even close. Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, if you read Fox's Book of Martyrs, if you ever read Fox's Book of Martyrs, one problem with Fox's Book of Martyrs is he doesn't mention any of the Catholics that were executed by the Protestants. There's a little bit of bias there. All right, because when in England, it kind of went back and forth. When the Protestants came in power, they start executing all the Catholics. And the Catholics would come back in power, they start executing all the Protestants. And it went back and forth two or three times. So there you go. So, and basically, John Huss was reading John Wycliffe. Wycliffe is what, about 50 years before. John Wycliffe was still alive. When John Huss was alive, but by the time he took the pulpit, Wycliffe had been dead. But he began teaching and reading from Wycliffe, and Wycliffe had already been excommunicated. So if you start teaching from the pulpit things from an excommunicated person, that's going to be a little bit of a problem. Here's a great quote from John Huss. I am ready with all my heart to obey the apostolic mandates, but I call apostolic mandates the doctrines of the apostles of Christ. And so far as the papal mandates agree with these, so far will I obey them most willingly. But if I see anything at variance with the Word of God, I shall not obey. Even though the stake were staring me in the face, which is exactly what was staring John Huss in the face. He said, only God can forgive sins. And as Wycliffe had done, he rejected idols and worshiping through the saints. He was called before the Council of Constance in 1415, where he was promised safe conduct. So the papal powers had said, we guarantee if you come, you'll be safe, you won't be arrested, you won't be harassed. Well, so much for that. Instead, he was thrown into a Dominican dungeon. He was called before the bishops to answer for his faith. And he said, I, Jan Hus, in hope, a priest of Jesus Christ, fearing to offend God and fearing to fall into perjury, or to hereby profess my unwillingness to abjure all or any of the articles produced against me by false witnesses. And if it were possible that my voice could now reach the whole world at the day of judgment, every lie and every sin that I've committed will be made manifest, then would I gladly abjure before all the world every falsehood and error which I ever have thought of saying or actually said. And he was burned at the stake in 1415. There's a depiction of that scene. His executioners ordered that all the dirt surrounding where this burning of the stake had happened be dug up and then thrown into the Rhine River so none could carry any relics of their martyred leader. Now, yes?
I think you said yesterday the Catholic Church apologized for these things?
Well, let me see. Yes, the Catholic Church has apologized for a lot of things. I don't know specifically whether they've apologized for this particular thing. I'm guessing that they probably have. Yes?
What is the reason behind being able to execute someone for heresy? Like, what is their... How would they defend it?
Because if you're going after the church is the body of Christ, and therefore to oppose the church is to oppose Christ. This is in the time of Christendom. So basically, to go against the church was to be a traitor. Later on, we're going to find that's going to be very significant in Zwingli's Reformation, because Zwingli was unwilling to turn against infant baptism. Not, we'll see, he studied the Bible with these guys who started the Anabaptist movement. He discovered that baptism would only be upon faith, but he was unwilling to give up baptism of infants simply for this reason, because baptism was citizenship. In other words, the roles of those who've been baptized as babies is also the role of citizens of the nation. So to abjure that infant baptism would be to abjure your very citizenship. It would be to commit, you'd be a traitor against the state. All right, so to go against the church would be to be a traitor. And capital punishment, absolutely. Right, and you have to understand, the first Reformation was also a magisterial Reformation. The first attempt at separating church from state will be the Anabaptists, as we'll see later on in our lesson today, okay? So these first attempts at Reformation, what you had to do is, this is why Luther's was the first successful Reformation, because he got actual rulers to say, if the Catholic Church wants to come in and take out Martin Luther, they're going to have to take us out first. You couldn't have a Reformation that was not magisterial. It was literally impossible. Because if the law, as long as the king says anybody who disagrees with my religion is going to be killed, how can you start a church? And we'll see that's exactly what happened to the Anabaptists. But a baptism into an Anabaptist church was preparation for martyrdom. And I don't know what the average lifespan was of these early conversions, but it was probably only a few months on average. Yeah. Yes.
But these executions on grounds of heresy by the church was definitely like not biblical, like at all.
Jesus said, "Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you." Yeah, I mean, this is so obvious. I mean, you know, this is so obvious. Now, of course, we know that God has given the state, you know, in Romans 14, right? Romans 14. The state does not have the sword for nothing. So God has, I believe, purposely separated church from state. That's what I think, because the state has to do some things. This is a fallen world. And so, you know, you may not like, you know, we may be pacifists as Christians. I lean strongly towards pacifism personally. But honestly, if our country didn't have an army, we'd have a big problem, right? So keeping state and church completely, utterly separate entities is a good idea. All right. Now, I'm not, I hope I'm not making a political statement, but I'm, you know, yeah. So from the time of Augustine until I'll show you. It might not be until Phoenix, but I'll show where separation of church and state finally happened. The first place it was in Holland in 1586. Where you could actually have a church that was not tied to the state. Okay, got it? So, anyway, John Huss had limited immunity there in Bohemia because of good King Wenceslas, essentially. But ultimately, they call in the king and they say, all right, you got a choice here. You either go with Wycliffe or we kill you. And we know what happened there. We'll see a little bit about that. All right, so anyway, he was burned at the stake, and unlike Wycliffe, whose Reformation basically more or less ended, Huss's did not, because this area of Bohemia was Hussite. It was, and eventually became the Brethren Church, which is still around. Later on, we'll see about Count Zinzendorf and the Moravians. The Moravians and the Brethren. I know I'm getting pretty obscure on you here. This church is still around. There are hundreds of thousands of people that are part of the church, essentially, that began because of Huss's movement. When Luther started his Reformation, there were roughly 200,000 faithful members of this church that Huss had started. All right? They're kind of in hiding and careful and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so Huss's movement, unlike that of Wycliffe, did not die when Huss was killed. His followers formed the Hussite League, which, you know, they published their four articles in Prague, the right of preaching the scripture without hindrance, Eucharist to be administered in both kinds. The clergy lost all their property to the church. Everything was taken away from the church. The mortal sins to be punished by those whom, to whom it pertains. Anyway, so anyway, there two parties emerged. There was the one, the radical party. They called them the Taborites. And they basically said, we're going to throw away all of Catholicism. And that group, they're the kind of the restorationist group, just the Bible, all that kind of stuff. And they splintered into dozens of groups within just a few years. And they were never able to come up with a unity platform. Then there were the less radical groups called the Ultraquists. And they're willing to kind of, you know, with Rome, we'll kind of work with you. You know, we won't get rid of transubstantiation. We won't get rid of indulgences, but we want the Lord's Supper in both kinds, and we want to be able to, you know, have lay preaching and these kinds of things. And for about 30 years or so, these two groups worked together. So the Pope sent crusade after crusade after crusade to kill these people and conquer their territory. And the only time it was ever able to succeed is when the two wings of the Hussite movement split. And the Ultraquists said, sure, we'll let you in. And then this movement finally was brought to an end. So the Taborites said the Bible is the only rule of faith. Only the Lord's Supper and baptism are sacraments. They renounced purgatory, indulgences, simony, all these things. I'm telling you, if John Huss had stayed alive, he would have been with these Taborites. It was a restoration movement. But restoration movements tend to fracture very quickly. Because when we say the Bible is the only authority, all right, but then what are the essential things? Those who try to restore, and we'll come back to this theme, if you're trying to restore New Testament Christianity, the question is, what are we restoring? And that's a very difficult question to answer. And the tendency is for people to say, everything, we have to agree on everything. And so typically restoration movements are highly divisive, fracture very quickly. That's what happened to the Taborites. That's what happened to the Anabaptists. It's what happened to the Sandemanians, who you never heard of, because they fractured. Okay, so this is something we have to learn, is how are we going to maintain unity as a fellowship when we say, at least in principle, that our only source of truth is the Bible rather than some creed that was written by people. All right, anyway. So eventually, in the mid-15th century, the Taborites became known as the Brethren Church. They translated the Bible into Bohemian. They had a hymnal. And there were 200,000 members still around when Luther's Reformation happened. All right? So, next, Byzantium fell in 1453. That's a big moment in the history of Christianity. The Reformation. So, principal figures in the Reformation would be John Wycliffe. The dates, I think, are fairly significant. John Huss, Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, William Tyndale. I'm not going to say much about Tyndale, but he's the first one to produce a modern translation of the Bible into English from Greek and Hebrew. He got burned at the stake also, although they gave him the grace that they killed him first and then they burned his body at the stake. They kind of helped him out that way, for having the nerve to translate the Bible into English. John Calvin, obviously. So we probably will not be able to cover John Calvin today. We'll see. We'll see how far we get. Okay, so the next person is Martin Luther. Well, I can do that sort of quickly. All right, I guess I'll just sort of go through my slides and say, oh, is there anything that Brian missed? Which is, the answer is not much. He was an Augustinian monk. That's very important to understand. Because what Calvin and Zwingli and Luther did was they restored Augustine. Oops! What they should have restored is Jesus and Paul and Peter and John. But they restored Augustine. They actually moved backward! Because Thomas Aquinas moved forward. And they said, no, we're going to go backward. Now remember, we talked about orthopraxy and heteropraxy and orthodoxy and heterodoxy. In terms of establishing orthopraxy, the Reformation was a tremendous success. In other words, restoring Christian practice to biblical practice and biblical patterns, especially Zwingli, not so much Luther. But as far as restoring biblical theology and biblical understanding of God, I would say maybe not much progress at all. And that's the state even today. Even today. All right, anyway, studied Romans. He came up with the idea of sola scriptura, sola gratia, and sola whatever the Latin word for faith is, I forget. All right, and we're good on grace alone, right? Yeah, that's good, grace alone. No works, right? Grace alone. Faith alone? No, not so much, because faith that alone is faith that won't save you. And Martin Luther, this is the principal doctrine of the Reformation. The principal doctrine that defines the Reformation is the doctrine of faith alone, which is false doctrine. So that's why we can see there might be a little bit of a problem there. And that's Martin Luther, who kind of swung the pendulum, and he had some pretty good reasons to want to swing that pendulum. He studied the book of Romans, and when he translated the Bible into German, he literally added the German word for alone to Romans. Not so good. A strong predestinationist, but I'll talk about that, got backtracked a bit. He called the book of James a book of straw. All right. Do I have a quote on that? I might have it in my notes. Kind of cool what he said about the book of James. Sort of cool, but mostly not cool, actually. Let me see. Oh, I don't have it here. Basically, he said, there is none of the gospel in the book of James. Now, it can be a little bit exaggerated. In the first edition of his Bible, he quite literally moved the book of James to an appendix. All right, but in later editions of his German Bible, he put it back after Hebrews and before 1 Peter, and he somewhat backed off. I think it's a little bit exaggerated how radically he hated the book of James, but he was not a big fan of the book of James, as you can imagine. All right, his was the first successful Reformation. And what's the definition? What's the definition of successful? Right. It was accepted as the state religion. All right. And it became the state religion in Sweden, in Finland, in Denmark, in Norway, and about half of Germany, parts of Holland, and parts of Poland. Okay. Lutheranism became the state religion. Okay. Unlike Zwingli, he kept much of Catholic worship. He still had priests wearing robes, or ministers wearing robes and things like that, and stained glass windows. His Reformation was not as radical as that of Zwingli. He said, free will is an empty term whose reality is lost, and a lost liberty is not liberty at all. Basically, he said, we have free will. We get to choose which sin we do, but not that we are sinners. So he believed in total depravity and original sin. Yes?
If you can choose to sin, what sin you're going to do, wouldn't that automatically mean you have the choice to do the right thing?
Well, not according to Augustine, that's for sure. And not according to... We're going to read some quotes from Calvin and Zwingli. And right here, I mean, apparently that's not what... Martin Luther rejected the idea of free will. Or what he did was he made free will into a hollow shell. And he and Erasmus, I haven't mentioned Erasmus yet. Erasmus was a brilliant, incredible, amazing Catholic theologian whose heart was very much behind what the Reformers would do, but his head wasn't. He didn't want to get killed. He stayed a Catholic. And so he and Luther debated over this. And they published sort of... against each other. And so the stronger Erasmus defended the Catholic and Christian doctrine of free will, the stronger Luther went into the other camp. He said, free will is a fiction. So did he believe in free will? Apparently not, okay? Everything takes place by absolute necessity. Again, like Augustine, He took God's sovereignty as his chief quality, if you will. Okay, got it? Away with James. There's the quote. I knew it would be there somewhere. All right, his authority is not great enough to cause me to abandon the doctrine of faith alone. By the way, the word alone is not in this quote, but trust me, that's what he's talking about. And to deviate from the authority of the other apostles and the entire scripture. St. James' epistle is really an epistle of straw compared to these others, such as his favorite, which would be Galatians and Romans, of course. For it has nothing of the nature of the gospel about it. All right, strengths and weaknesses. Clearly, his rejection of the idea of human beings have sovereignty over their own will, that's problematic, to say the least. However, he restored much of biblical practice. And, the fact that he wasn't killed is absolutely amazing. It's a miracle. All right. Like Augustine, he overemphasized God's sovereignty, trying to reform Catholicism rather than restoring New Testament theology, to me, is a limitation that he had. By the way, yes?
Just a quick question. I'm just thinking logically, if there's no free will, what's the point in him doing whatever he's doing?
All right. Again, if you say to Calvinists, such as Baptists or Presbyterians, your theology is inconsistent with evangelism, they are unfazed by that. They've thought that through and they've kind of figured it out for themselves. Right. Why would you bother to share your faith if you knew that it has no effect on who's going to go to heaven or not? But their answer is something like this. Well, God has preordained who I'm going to share my faith with, and he's kind of all working it out. So you'll find people who believe in Calvinism who share their faith quite actively. You're saying it's inconsistent. I agree 100%. But since when did being inconsistent with what you do and what the logic of what you believe, since when did that stop people? Including you and I, I'm sure, occasionally.
Maybe.
All right.
Free.
Yeah. So I agree with your premise, but, ask them. Ask them to defend their ideas. Okay. By the way, one thing we're going to do, not this section, next session, we're going to have a dueling thing. So half of you are going to get together in small groups and come up with a proof for Calvinism.
Nice.
The other half of you are going to come up with a proof for, the correct answer. So we're going to do a little debating back and forth. That's what we're going to do. Okay? Anyway, it turns out that instead of calling it Lutheranism, we should probably call it Melanchthonism, I guess. Because the bottom line is, Philip Melanchthon was this brilliant scholar, the right-hand person of Luther. Luther married, he had children, he had a wonderful family, by the way, and he was the model of the Christian family in Germany for hundreds of years. Luther, despite the fact that he was kind of a hater of the Jews and wanted to kill all of them, wipe out all those peasants, he had some good qualities, all right? He was very grumpy, very, very grumpy, famous for being grumpy, but nevertheless. Anyway, his right-hand person was Philip Melanchthon, a greater theologian and scholar even than Martin Luther. And he outlived Martin Luther by, I think, around 35 years. And so what became Lutheranism is the product of Melanchthon's theology. And Melanchthon was not a predestinationist. So we're going to talk about Reformed theology. Reformed theology comes from Zwingli and Calvin. But Lutheranism is surprisingly like Catholicism. I mean, if you allow for celibate priesthood and a pope, Lutheranism, man, I'm telling you, it's surprising how much it looks like Catholicism. And that has more to do with Philip Melanchthon than Martin Luther. So we're going to talk about Calvinism, and the Lutheran Church is not Calvinist. But the problem, that's good, I guess. But the fact is, the Lutheran Church did not determine the direction that the Reformation ultimately took. All right, so Melanchthon was Luther's right-hand person, chief theologian. He rejected a harsh predestination. He had a fairly mild kind of predestination. He did not believe in limited atonement and those kinds of things. So Lutherans are not Calvinists. That's worth bearing in mind when you're talking to them. Don't assume they're like most Protestants. Okay? Now, the next person is Ulrich Zwingli. Ulrich Zwingli is the most important person in the Reformation in terms of understanding how the direction of Christianity went. Luther created this branch that just sort of, it just stopped. Right? But the branch of Protestantism known as Reformed theology that ultimately led to what John Calvin did, that's the kind that produced almost all non-Catholic Christianity in the Western world. So what Ulrich Zwingli did and taught is more important to understand. Now, arguably, Luther changed history more than Zwingli, arguably. But Ulrich Zwingli changed Christianity more than Luther. Got it? Mm-hmm. So as a historical figure, I think you could say Luther more significant. But anyway, so Zwingli is a Swiss reformer. How am I doing? Oh, okay, I'm doing well here. Similar to Luther, but quite a bit more radical. Now, Luther went from 1517, he's just a Catholic priest, hardly different from any other Catholic priest, and then 5 years later, he got this full-blown Reformation. Zwingli, it was more like a 12 or 15-year process. His Reformation was much more gradual than that of Luther's, but it was definitely more thorough than that of Luther's, for better and for worse, both. He began this Reformation in Zurich, which was the largest city in what we know as Switzerland. And Switzerland was back then is what it is today. All right. He created what we know as Reformed theology. And I'll give a list of the denominations which are essentially Reformed theology, which is most Protestant denominations. All right. Zwingli was a humanist. So Luther was very skeptical of humanism. Luther was very skeptical, although he was a professor, highly educated, he was very skeptical about human reason. But Zwingli was much more of a humanist. He was more in line with Erasmus in this humanist Reformation that was coming within the Catholic Church. All right, and so he was more accepting of the idea of using human reasoning to describe Christianity. The turning point for Zwingli. What was the turning point for Luther?
A lightning storm,
right. The turning point for Zwingli was a bit different. All right, he was forced to join the Swiss troops fighting outside of Switzerland. So in the Middle Ages, the Swiss troops, they were the best troops. Like, if you wanted to win a war, let's say you're the Pope and you're trying to fight off the Emperor in northern Italy, you'd want to get those Swiss soldiers because they were the fierce ones, the mountainous tribes. So the Swiss were constantly being dragged into all these wars. Sometimes they fight wars for the French king. Sometimes they fight wars for the German emperor. And sometimes they fight wars for the Pope and his allies. It's crazy stuff. So Zwingli found himself doing that, and he began to see that the papacy was the enemy of Switzerland. A little bit like Wycliffe, his first conversion was kind of almost political. Like, Wycliffe was like, how can we let these people in Rome do this to our people? It began partially as a political thing. Same with Huss. He's like, why are we letting the Pope, make us fight in his wars? What's going on there? So he became a rebel, but he wasn't very spiritual at the time. All right? But in 1513, so what he did was he became a scholar, started studying Greek. He was a great, great student of Greek. And he said, I'm not a Lutheran, he said famously, Zwingli. I'm not a Lutheran because I learned Greek in 1513 before anybody ever heard of Martin Luther. So his Reformation started before Luther, but it stretched over about a 12-year period. Anyway, ultimately became more radical than Luther's in Wittenberg and more complete. He rejected the idea of priestly garments, of statues, of stained glass windows, and yes, musical instruments. He argued that the early church did not use musical instruments, which is true, by the way. All right, and that's a Church of Christ thing. We could talk about that later on. Basically, they described Zwinglian's churches as four walls and a sermon. All right? Just took everything out. And Catholic churches were desecrated. You know, the artwork's torn out. Luther never did that. He never smashed the stained glass windows. He never destroyed the statues. But in Zurich, he had all those statues got broken down. All those stained glass windows were taken out. And basically all vestiges of anything even remotely Roman were just taken out. That's what Zwingli did. Four bare walls and a sermon. It is no accident at all that the Anabaptist movement came from Zwingli's Reformation, not from Luther. Because Zwingli, he almost became an Anabaptist. It was like this close.
He should have.
But then if he had, his Reformation would have ended, by the way.
Well,
if he'd become an Anabaptist, he too would have been killed.
Prideful.
So, there you go. Anyway, there was a meeting in Zurich with Grebel and Sattler and all these other early history figures in the Anabaptist movement, all of whom were executed within a year of that meeting, in which they agreed, along with Zwingli, that baptism should be only for adults who have faith. And Zwingli left that meeting, and it was like, yes! And then he got home, he's like, uh-oh, if I do that, well, there's going to be some really crazy stuff happening on. So Zwingli's Reformation, like that of Luther's, was magisterial. So basically then they had to defeat Catholic powers. And I'm going to get ahead of myself right now, because Zwingli died with a sword in his hand, fighting in a battle to defeat Catholics who were trying to conquer Zurich. I don't know how Christian that is, but anyway, that's what he was doing. His another thing is he differed with, as was mentioned already, he differed with Luther on the Lord's Supper. By the way, Luther was not a transubstantiationist. Luther was into what's called consubstantiation. So he said it's not like the bread literally becomes the body of Christ when the priest does Om Mani Padme Hum or whatever they do, and the wine does not become the blood of Jesus. It says that Jesus sort of mystically enters these elements. So his was not transubstantiation. But the bottom line is, when we eat the bread and we drink the wine, we are eating and drinking the Lord, but not physically. So his was not like crazy whacked out stuff. And who knows, maybe he's even right. He might be right, I don't know. I know that transubstantiation is wrong. That's definitely wrong. You can think about that. I tend to agree with Zwingli, but Zwingli was the first important figure to declare that it is a remembrance. And he said that's all it is. Well, that created a problem with Luther. How am I doing here? Okay, I got about three or four more minutes. So Zwingli, this is really, really important, guys and ladies, excuse me, people. He said, sacraments are signs or ceremonies by which people offer themselves before the church as soldiers or disciples of Christ. He completely rejected the idea that sacrament has any effect. He said, sacraments are merely symbolic acts. Well, there are two, arguably, sacraments in the Bible. What would be the two, if you want to call them that? I don't like the word, honestly. But what are the two sacraments that are in the Bible? Yeah, and whether communion is a sacrament, whether it imparts anything other than being a remembrance. If you call communion a sacrament, you're probably kind of a little bit more with Luther. But nevertheless, and basically he said they don't actually do anything. So he said baptism is an outward sign of an inward grace.
Mercy.
1526 or 1525, something like that. So when people tell you that baptism is an outward sign of inward grace, you can say it is a fact, it is a historical fact that was not taught by any Christian before the 16th century. So what you just told me, if that's right, then every Christian who lived before 1520-something was wrong. And therefore, I guess you're right. So that's a problem. And basically what he said is, And by the way, what's a little confusing is there is a type-anti-type relationship between circumcision and baptism, which you can find in Colossians 2. A little confusing. But he said essentially that baptism is exactly like circumcision. So the circumcision of a Jewish young boy is a symbol of what was already true. That young boy was already a Jew before they were circumcised. And in fact, Paul even says that in Romans 4, right? And so Zwingli said, that's exactly the same with baptism. And the problem is, Colossians 2 tells us that circumcision is a, that baptism is a spiritual circumcision. So, you know, there's that stuff there. It's a little complicated, but here's the fact, that we are saved when we're baptized, okay? And it certainly is not an outward sign of an inward grace. So this was a huge loss for Christianity. And the problem is, Zwingli defined Protestant Christianity, not Martin Luther. All right, it's, oh, I've got one more minute. All right, now, Zwingli was even a more radical predestinationist than Luther. Oh, yes, he was. He said, those individuals who end up damned forever in hell are also equally determined by God for that fate. So Zwingli, and probably really more Calvin than even Zwingli, invented this idea of the elect and the reprobate. And yesterday Greg said something like, I'm a reprobate. All right, great. But you don't mean a Zwinglian reprobate, right? No, no. Because a reprobate is a person who, before the world was created, was predestined by God to go to hell. And Jesus definitely didn't die for that person. That is Ulrich Zwingli. If you ever see paintings in, well, not pictures. If you see paintings of Zwingli, they all kind of look like that. What? Wow, a really happy guy, you know, a really happy-go-lucky guy there, you know. All right. Well, that's good enough. I'll finish up with Zwingli and do a little bit with the Anabaptists after Greg's. So Greg's up next, and then I'll be back. Break. All right, making progress.
Great stuff, John.
Thanks. See ya.
Give Jen a hug for me.
Will do. Where are you going to worship tomorrow? Okay.
National City, you're welcome.
We're going to be in...